Hello, everyone, and welcome.
We know that there were some exceptional other breakout sessions today, so we feel very grateful that you chose to spend this time with us. We are going to be talking about some of the most common ethical challenges and decisions that we have found our patients and their loved ones in as we navigate the end of life. Before we dive into this, though, I thought we could start with introductions. What you'll find is this is Dr. Sikora, while I can't help but call him Joe. And throughout the day, I just want to be viewed as Rosie. We really want to take this presentation as friends. You have a provider, a physician, you have a social worker. With my decade of experience and his combined, we have like 100 years of practice service together. No one caught the joke.
Combined.
Yeah, combined. Yeah. And so, you know, we want to tell you a little bit about us, but really that's how we're going to go about this, is like we'd have this conversation if we were sitting down with you in your living room. So, Joe, why don't you go first?
So when I talk at groups like this, I often refer to myself as the accidental hospice doctor. I'm a family doc by original training, and when I first started, hospice was almost barely begun around in the U.S. and wasn't even on my radar as something that I might want to pursue in my career. Back in the beginning, as Dr. Sandler probably remembers, back in the 80s, you know, primary care docs did everything. They went to the hospital. They saw people in clinic. They saw people in the nursing home. There were no such thing as hospitalists. There was no such thing as intensivists. And so back in about early 2000s, I was rounding in the hospital, and the previous hospice medical director of North Memorial was leaving because the job was not full-time at North, and he wanted to do this work full-time. So he was leaving, and he literally had 2 weeks to go, and he says to me, "Hey, you want to be hospice medical director?" And so fortunately, I always tell people it was October and not spring, because I'm a big golfer, and I guarantee if he had asked me in the spring, I would have just said no. It was October. I felt like I had time on my hands. I said, "I'd be happy to help, but you guys keep looking." I literally signed a 6-month contract to help out with North Memorial Hospice with the intent of going back to my regular life. 2 months in, I realized this was where I was supposed to be. And so it was, in some senses, a calling, and my life has slowly, I still do 1 day a week of primary care because I've been seeing people for 35 years and couldn't walk away, but most of my life is hospice and palliative.
And my journey is a little bit different. I actually became a social worker so I could practice in hospice. So about 12, 13 years ago, I was living in Key West and living quite the life, but yet felt this nudge that I needed to figure out what was next for me. So I came back home and I started volunteering in a few different settings, and one was hospice. And within a month, I let go of all those other volunteer opportunities, and I started, it was like 10 hours a week. Within a few months, I was enrolled in a Master's of Social Work program. My family's patients and team members know that I commonly say I do feelings and not fluids. I don't have a rock-hard stomach, so for me, the combination of counseling as well as the social justice aspect of social work really felt aligned with who I was as a person. You guys heard my bio been read this morning, so I don't need to go further into that. But essentially, in the last 10 years, my passion for this space has not waxed or waned. Something Joe and I are both very passionate about is sharing what we have learned at the bedside as people are at the end of their life and bringing it into these spaces long before people are dying. We know that we don't make good decisions in moments of stress, urgency, crisis, especially when this is new information. Especially when we have a layer of grief on top of it. We make better decisions when we can get education early, when we can reflect and process on it, when we can have discussions with our most important people. And so that's really our primary objective and goal today, is to give you some information now, to get you to start reflecting now, so when you find yourself at the end of your life, or you're caring for somebody who is at the end of yours, you can make better decisions later. And that really is our focus. It is to give you some tools and some education as caregivers and also as individuals who, like Joe says, we're all going to die someday. So giving that information for both. We are talking about the 6 most common ethical challenges that we see at the end of life, and each of these could be an hour long. I'm going to be transparent. So we're going to breeze over these, and we're going to save plenty of time for questions at the end. So first and foremost, a little audience participation. Who has a healthcare directive? Raise your hand. Nice work, guys.
Better than expected.
Yes. Okay, so raise your hand if you have had a detailed conversation with your healthcare agent about what your wishes and your values and your goals are for your healthcare, your end-of-life care. Okay. So lastly...
I don't think your family counts.
Yeah, I don't think so either. Yeah, they are forced. My death anxiety comes into play. So, and one more time, just so we can know who's in the room as well, too, will you please raise your hand if you are in a position right now where you are an active healthcare agent or surrogate decision maker for somebody right now? You are in that role. Thank you. Truly thank you for what you do. This is the most common ethical challenge that we find ourselves in as clinicians and we see loved ones in. First, when we think about decision making, one ethical challenge we see is that capacity waxes and wanes. Now, there are some people who have very advanced dementia, and we know that we need these surrogate decision makers to step in and make all decisions. But oftentimes, this is on a continuum. It isn't binary. And so sometimes we will have caregivers or decision makers come in and say, oh, before you go into the room, can you tell me what the test result was? When that patient does still have capacity. They want us to give them the information before we give the patient, and ethically, we just can't do that. Sometimes it's getting them to understand of how can they make decisions alongside each other, and I want you to hear me loud and clear. I don't ever believe this is malicious, ever. Most of the time, this is just them wanting to protect that person, wanting to love that person, take care of that person. Another issue that we commonly see is when people don't have a healthcare directive. So we have something in Minnesota, and it's called shared decision-making. I will tell you, as a social worker, sometimes it's a blessing because we don't have next of kin laws here in Minnesota. So what that means is, I'll just use my family for example, is if something were to happen to me and I were to get in a car accident, my husband's voice does not override my sister's. That's not what the laws of Minnesota say. So the supportive decision making can be helpful for people who don't really have a large support system. I've had pharmacists sign patients up for hospice because that's the person who knew this unhoused individual the best. So there's places where it's graceful, but there's times where it's really harmful. I had a case while working with Joe, and it was inpatient, and it was a gentleman with the most advanced Parkinson's I've ever seen in my career. And his wife was saying, no more, no more, no tube feeding, no more, let's just go to hospice. And the 2 adult children were saying, absolutely not. We're going to do everything we can to keep Dad alive. And we had, I want to say, 5 or 6 care conferences trying to get them on the same page. Eventually, what resulted in is we had to file for emergency guardianship for a guardian to come in and make this decision. So imagine the impact that can have on your family. Joe, can you talk a little bit about decision making?
Can I ask a question, or do you want questions now or later?
I prefer to do questions at the end, if that's okay, just because we want to get through these 6, and then we'll have some good time, I promise.
So, as Rosie said, a lot of times the who gets to make a decision is really difficult. I've spent most of my, since getting on hospice, I was told I had to be on the ethics committee at North. A couple years later, when I missed a meeting, the previous chair of the committee resigned and retired, and so I got voted in as chair 15 years ago. And as Rosie says, these, I would say the vast majority of our ethics consults in the hospital end up being related to who gets to decide and or does the patient have capacity to decide. And the vast majority of time my first question always is, do they have a healthcare directive? Do they have an agent? And most of the time they don't. And so it really gets complicated trying to figure out who gets to decide what's in the best interest of this patient, who has the best interest of this patient at heart, and how do we get there? And so it's having a healthcare directive is the absolute best thing that you can do, and having talked with your healthcare agent about the kinds of things that you'd want so they understand exactly what you would likely want to do in a certain situation.
I use the language of fork in the road. Oftentimes we've seen this in the hospital, or, you know, eventually these patients sometimes go to Joe within hospice, where I'll sit with a family and it will be discussing, do we go to the ICU? Do we continue to do aggressive treatment, or do we transition to hospice? We find ourselves in these fork in the roads where this is where this detailed healthcare directive is helpful. I want to tell you, in my inpatient work, I have seen hundreds of healthcare directives. Most that are drafted by attorneys are not good. I'm just being honest with you. They give you a clear healthcare agent, but they don't actually go into details of what quality of life means to you. When life stops having quality, when we should stop going to the ICU, and when we should stop getting aggressive treatment, and when we should allow for comfort. You know, so I recommend too, when you're in a healthcare system, you know, if you can sit down with a social worker, sit down with a nurse, sit down with a death doula, and talk through these pieces and add them. So even if you've done with one with an attorney, can we add a few sheets of paper to that really talk about what we do in these fork in the road circumstances?
I just want to say I have recent personal experience, not as a professional. My mother died about a month ago. She had Alzheimer's, and I was one of her main caregivers up until that time. We had to move her into a facility about 9 months ago and found a wonderful place. She was getting great care. I was flying home from D.C. Visiting a grandchild, which is an amazing, amazing thing, by the way, and I got a call from the facility and my sister that my mother started having seizures, and I reemphasized with them that we had talked and wanted to avoid hospitalization, and the facility was clearly not very comfortable doing that without having the support of hospice. And so we ended up, had a wonderful team at my hospice program who were able to go out and see her and identify clearly that these were seizures, because she had no history of seizures prior to this. And I can't tell you how hard it was as a son, knowing as a doctor that the likelihood of her having anything reversible that would bring her back to the level she had been at the day before was virtually zero, and that a hospitalization was going to really negatively impact her quality of life in the short run. So I was able to insist that we don't send her to the hospital, and she was with us for 2 more weeks. We were able to get her seizures under control without ever learning. And unfortunately, the medical examiner doesn't like when we don't know for sure what was going on, because she'd had a fall in close proximity to when these seizures occurred. So she was, after death, brought into the medical examiner's office, and they were able to find that there was no trauma that contributed to these seizures, which was really good. But it was really, really hard as the decision maker, as my mom's power of attorney, to, and as well prepared as I was to understand the medical consequences and having to deal with my family, that there was just no good that was going to come out of going to the hospital to address this issue of new seizures.
And I think that's an important piece to validate, that even a physician who has all this knowledge, there's a psychological piece that goes along with being a decision maker. I am Joe's personal social worker, and so we had multiple phone calls as he was navigating that. You know, it's a heavy space to be, and something that we're just trying to get through that can make this process easier is when at least we can have the confidence of saying, I am not making decisions on behalf of them. I'm honoring their decisions. So if you are in a place, some of you raised your hand, that you are someone's active healthcare agent right now, the questions I commonly ask you is, think about who that person has been throughout their life. What has life meant to them? What has quality of life meant to them? You know, if they could be a fly on the wall right now in this hospital room as we're talking about these two different decisions, what do you think they would pick? How can we pull it outside of you as a son and pull it back into what Susie would have wanted for herself? And knowing her and knowing you, I think you really honored her decision. So I want to let you guys know that I apologize that they aren't printed out, but at the end of this, there is a resource guide that you can access. I'm also happy to email it out. And I loaded this thing up. So recognizing that some of you may say, like, what questions can I be asking my loved ones? I put a lot of that stuff in there and a lot of the resources that we're going to be talking about today. I do want to keep going, though, because I want time for questions. CPR. Joel, can you just describe CPR?
CPR stands for cardiopulmonary resuscitation, which means that your heart has stopped. In other words, that's how we've defined death for centuries and centuries. You have just died, and at some level, to resuscitate you means we get to torture you, bring you back to life before we let you die again. And I'm that blunt sometimes in talking with patients about the decision, because I know Rosie has some statistics which most people don't know about the likelihood of surviving and recovering to anything resembling where you were at before. And often involves a tube to breathe for you. My wife is a nurse who just recently retired a couple of years ago and taught CPR, and they would teach people and tell them about breaking ribs. It's almost inevitable, especially in older people, that in the process of resuscitating them and you know, external compressions, that the ribs are going to break and they are not going to do well after, even if they are able to recover. And so I tend to try my hardest to be very discouraging about people choosing to have resuscitation as they get closer to the end of life.
So with that, just think in your head, if you had to guess, what percentage of the time do you think CPR is successful? You don't have to say it out loud, just think it in your head.
25.
Okay. Anyone else have a guess?
Yeah.
Some of you guys are, you set them up to think so. So the most recent statistics is out of the hospital, and this is for all adults, so we need to remember these numbers are for people who are 18, healthy, with no chronic conditions, all the way to people who are at the end of their life. So the survival rate for out-of-the-hospital cardiac arrest is 12%. It is 24 to 40% if you're in an inpatient setting. So that means you have literally doctors, monitors, you have everything right there.
You were right on.
And if for those that reside in a nursing home, the chance is 3%. TV does a really garbage job of making us think it's successful. My sister and I both love to watch medical shows, and whenever they give CPR, and all of a sudden the person's like, what happened? I'm like, that's not how it works. That's not how it works. And so, you know, Joe, you touched on this a little bit, but even when we look at these numbers, what this means is that CPR got their heart to start beating again. Usually what we see is that then somebody has to have a tube down their throat to help them breathe. They get admitted into an ICU. And especially for those that we see, and Doc, you jump in at any time, but especially for those that we see that are at the end of their life or that have a lot of chronic conditions or just more fragile, is that we can't get them off that breathing machine. So then what results is the families have to make this decision of when do we, what we call a compassionate extubation.
Exactly. It just prolongs the suffering to a great extent, and if they had not already had a healthcare directive saying they didn't want CPR, they often also didn't have a healthcare directive that said when would they want to stop machines breathing for them. And so families often then feel like they're the ones pulling the plug, which is not what we want people to do. We want people to feel like, my mom already made this choice. I'm just honoring it. I don't want her to suffer anymore.
When people tell me, I'm doing this healthcare directive so my family knows when to pull the plug, I'm like, how about we don't get you plugged in to begin with if that's not what you want? So Joe talked about a healthcare directive, but if you are somebody who's sitting here saying, gosh, like, I don't want to go through CPR, I don't want someone I love to go through CPR, a healthcare directive is a guide, but it's not legal. It's not legally binding. Have any of you heard of this document called a PULSED before? Yeah, usually it's bright orange, right? So this is something that has to be signed by a medical provider like Joe or a nurse practitioner or a physician assistant. And so once this is signed, if an EMT goes to give you chest compressions and you pull this up for your loved one and say, no, they are DNR, like this is, then they won't. Aside from that, a healthcare directive, they still by law have to attempt resuscitations. So that's why this document is so important. If you or someone you know is saying, I do not want to have CPR, then you should get this taken care of with your primary. If you are a caregiver of that person, scan this into a PDF and have it, we all have carry around our phones, have it saved in an email. So if you need to pull that up really quick, you can pull up that post. Unfortunately, Minnesota, unlike Wisconsin, doesn't honor bracelets and things like this. So while we wish it was a really like rock solid, like this is really the best way that you can protect yourself when it comes to your wishes surrounding CPR. And before we move forward, Joe, I just want to ask, what is your code status?
I am DNR.
I just think that's something to know when you have a physician who is in good health, still practicing, and that is his wish. Again, and hear us loud and clear, in this room, our goal is not to push you into something that you are not ready for, but that's why we're up here as your friends, is to really give you kind of a straightforward truth when it comes to this.
When I did my mom's healthcare directive, and we talked, and I had to talk with her about it, she was already having some dementia, so it was hard to have a really heartfelt conversation. But finally, I just said, Mom, I'm DNR. You don't want to be resuscitated. And that was adequately convincing for her.
And you might have to push your physicians to talk about this. In my private practice, I serve people from their 40s to their 90s, and I have yet to have met with somebody who says, my doctor has had a thorough conversation with me about CPR. That's not to throw you guys under the bus. You are busy, you have a lot, but you might need to push this conversation a little bit as well. I'm going to keep us moving. The next is the feeding and hydrating dilemma. Man, I will say that this one, I think, is psychologically one of the hardest. We associate food with love, with connection, with ritual, and really basic needs. But as someone's body changes and they're getting closer to the end of their life, what they need as far as nutrients and hydration is much different than what we all need. Joe, can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, as you know, we're mostly speaking about people as they get closer to the end of life the last few months, but even long before that, people's metabolism is slowing. They don't need as many calories. Their thirst sensation goes down. Most people aren't drinking as much as they used to. But especially as they get towards the end of the life, their bodies aren't handling all of the stuff we're putting in as well. So it's that part of it, like everything else, is working less well than it once did. And so often we're causing more suffering when we're force feeding people and not doing them any good.
I get questions a lot, especially from surrogate decision makers of individuals with dementia. And again, most of my experience has been in hospice regarding, you know, they're now having trouble swallowing, the modified diet isn't working as well as it did, and they're really wanting a tube feed. Can you speak to that?
Unfortunately, it doesn't reduce the incidence of aspiration and people having complications of being fed, and it does not prolong their lives. And their digestive systems are slowing down just like the rest of them, and so often we're putting more food and more calories in them than they can even tolerate and not improving the quality of their life.
I hear concerns that I don't want my loved one to starve.
I always say, you know, I do a lot of work, obviously, on the hospice side once people have qualified. And I often answer that question by saying, you know, people choose to go on fasts for long periods of time. People don't starve to death in general. You know, we often say people are not eating because they're dying. They're not dying because they're not eating. And so people live for a long time without eating. On hospice, we see people going weeks on their deathbeds with literally no intake sometimes. And so people are not starving to death.
So one thing you can do about this, if you know your goals, you're going to hear us come back to the same thing because it's just the truth. You need a detailed healthcare directive. If you are that surrogate decision maker, on the second page of this post, it talks about goals surrounding eating and drinking. And God, I feel like I could keep talking about this circumstance for a bit, but the last thing I want to touch on, because I just had a case like this at the hospital about 2 weeks ago, as I was working with a family who is adamant that their loved one receive artificial hydration. And I educated, and ultimately my role is to respect whatever decision that individual or that family makes once they have all the information. When I went back to visit 2 days later, it literally sounded like he was drowning. And so, I mean, and I get it. This is such a common thing for people to say, well, I want them to be hydrated. Can you speak to hydration at end of life?
Yeah. I mean, sometimes no matter how much we educate people and talk about what's happening as people's bodies are dying and they're not able to tolerate all of this, we sometimes do exactly what happened in this case with time-limited trial. We negotiate with the family and we'll say, okay, I wish we weren't doing it this way, but let's give some fluids. We have people on hospice who are outside of the hospital who families are still pushing hard and trying to get more liquid, more food in them, and we have to keep having this discussion over and over and over and really point to what's happening with their loved one so that we can help convince them of the fact that this isn't really helping. And your mother or your father, whoever, is suffering more because of this. And so it's always a struggle.
I want to make you get more specific. I want you to talk about how dying a actually dehydrated death is far more comfortable than a wet death.
It is. I don't know how many of you have been in a room with somebody who's dying. And even when they're relatively dry, they often sound like they're not dry, and when they're really wet, they sound horrible. And so it's very distressing to loved ones to listen to the congestion that people have as they're dying, and trying to put more fluid, more food in them just makes that whole experience worse.
It goes to places it's not supposed to. That's why we see edema and in the lungs and those sorts of pieces. Sorry, I was just pushing you to get there.
Okay.
So I want to make sure that I'm thoughtful of time and questions. Can you raise your hand if so far you have a question for us when this is over? Okay, great. We still have some time. Okay. So next we want to talk about voluntarily stopping eating and drinking. This is commonly referred as VSED, and we actually have an expert in the room surrounding VSED. But we wanted to just briefly touch over this as well. So VSED is a legal and an ethical end-of-life option in which a mentally capable adult intentionally chooses to stop consuming food or fluids with the understanding that this will hasten their death. This is not the result of an eating disorder or depression or coercion, but this is a deliberate choice that is often made by individuals with a chronic or a terminal illness as they want to have some control over how they die. Patients who elect this option usually die within a week to several weeks. Joe and I have been talking sometimes. We both have cared for patients who have elected VSED. And sometimes even when you are so committed, you decide you want a little bit of water or something. And so that can make the process prolonged. What we have seen and what the research suggests is that this is generally painless, that this is usually a peaceful passing. Joe, is that what you've seen in your practice too?
Yeah, I think for most people who are interested, often the question comes up, is there anything I can do to speed this up? And we talk through some of the things that Rosie's going to talk about in a little bit. But I always say the one thing that you can do that is legal in the state of Minnesota is to stop eating and drinking. And we talk through the difficulty of that, how hard it is. For most people, it's the first 2-3 days that are the hardest, and often once they get through that, I don't know if any of you have ever gone on fasts for any reason, but often once you get through the first day or two, it gets easier in some respects. And obviously the people who we're talking about near the end of life have a lot of medical conditions, and so typically it won't go on for a long time because of the stress it's placing on the body.
What we are beginning to see, I mean, I started my career in hospice about 10 years ago, and I remember within that first year I had patients who chose to elect VSED. But what we are starting to see more of is requests for surrogate decision makers in regards to a loved one who has dementia and who is no longer able to make decisions for themselves. We hear things like, they really wouldn't want to live like this. Is this an option? What I will say is it's complex. It's complex. And a majority, I've worked with 6 different hospice agencies. I like temp work. The agencies I've worked in this circumstance where it is a surrogate decision maker making this decision for their loved ones, many really struggle with this and do not respect this option or do not allow this to happen unless there is some thorough documentation prior. So, for example, if somebody has a healthcare directive and in that healthcare directive they say, I would like to elect VSED if I get dementia, but here's the other key point, and then we need to talk about the functionality surrounding their dementia. When I get to the point that I can no longer recognize my wife, when I get to the point that I'm no longer ambulatory, or I'm incontinent, or I have to depend on people for my round-the-clock care, this is what I want for myself. It's also important to have what they call a Ulysses clause in there. And so essentially what that says is, listen to me now, the competent person that is creating this document. So when I do have dementia, when I am at this state, if I start asking for food and fluid, I don't want you to listen to my now. I want you to listen to me. I want you to listen to me right now, not me then. So there's really a lot of, I would say, pretty strict stipulations surrounding organizations that are willing to support this when it is a surrogate decision maker and not an individual who is able to make that competent decision at the time and say, no, I refuse food, I refuse water.
There's a lot of people, a lot of institutions, nursing homes, where even when it's well documented, some facilities just really, really struggle with not honoring because they're concerned about the ethical, legal implications of not feeding somebody.
Yeah, and like you said, even when they are capable of making that decision, there's some of these care facility settings that really, really have a hard time with it. I just want to call out that if you are somebody who is navigating these circumstances, Health Partners Hospice has one of the most, I would say actually the most in our Twin Cities area, advanced process surrounding VSED with an exceptional group of physicians that help guide that process and can help support families. I wanted to put that out there and highlight Health Partners because they really have done some very exceptional work. The other piece I wanted to tie to the healthcare directive piece, because maybe for you, you're saying, this is absolutely what I want. Having a video healthcare directive. So you have your written directive, but then you also have a video of you sitting there saying, this is what I want. This is what's important to me. This is what my goals are. So that can be shown to the medical team as well. Treating pain. Now, I'm sure many of you are like, Rosie, we're talking about hospice. We're talking about end of life. How, like, isn't this the main point of hospice, is to alleviate pain and suffering for those at the end of their life? And the answer is yes, absolutely. And what we see is that for a number of reasons, sometimes it's the patient, oftentimes it is the family or the decision makers that are hesitant, or I've had some that are just flat out resistant to allowing us to treat pain. Some of these reasons that we see are religious and cultural reasons. Again, how we view our role is we are here to provide education, thorough education, so you can make informed consent. Talk about the risks versus benefits, but ultimately our role is to respect anyone's culture or anyone's religious reasons of why they are choosing to either go forward with a treatment or decline a treatment. Another piece that we see is when our patients have had a prior history of addiction, right? So the idea of starting an opioid, man, it goes against something that they worked very, very hard on. Or if there's concerns for addiction, so I want to turn to you to speak about both of those. First, if somebody has a history of addiction and the concern for addiction.
Yeah, it gets complicated, and often you have to have long conversations with patients who have had addiction issues because they themselves are often reluctant to restart anything that might trigger their addiction. We talk through the fact that what we're doing now is treating legitimate symptoms, because the other part I wanted to raise is that often families think that hospice, we're just killing people quickly by giving them morphine and not actually helping them. And so there's a lot of education surrounding that. And typically with addiction, it's the patients themselves that are really concerned. And it just requires close, ongoing conversations and making sure that they're feeling secure about their symptoms and that we're having regular contact to make sure we're adequately treating their symptoms and not feeding into any of their addictions that they might be struggling with. And I think almost always we're able to treat their symptoms effectively without creating more anxiety mm-hmm. surrounding their addiction.
And for those who have concerns of addiction, according to the research and what we see in practice, the prevalence of becoming addicted to opioids when you are being treated by a hospice or a palliative care in those settings is extremely low. Because you're needing the medication. You're not taking it to get high. You're taking it because you have pain. And these are always started out as what I say is just baby doses. You know, the goal is always to manage this goal of symptom management, of comfort, and also functionality. So that's another concern that we hear is I have heard, again, mostly from families of, well, I don't want mom to get that medicine because I want her to be able to engage with me. I want her to be able to talk to me. So can you speak about the medications and...
Yeah, I mean, I think, as we all know, it's common for many of the medications we use to treat pain and anxiety that they can be a little bit sedating, especially with first doses or dose changes, but people tend to improve from that. And we also want to have people to have a choice in the matter. I use my dad as an example. He died on hospice 18, 19 years ago. He had pretty severe pain, and he was very clear that he wanted to be asleep and not feel any pain. And so his last 2 or 3 weeks were mostly sedated. We give people that option. We, how much medication they want to take, how much they want to be alert and interactive, and it might change over the course of the day. And that's why we have as-needed medications as well as scheduled medicine, so that they can have some control over what is controllable at the end of life.
And this is a space that I work with patients quite a bit as a hospice social worker, is I will have patients who say, I have things I need to get done. I have conversations I need to have with my loved ones. And when I say things to get done, I'm not talking about going to a trip to Europe, right? But it's these tasks that they need to feel like they have completed, or these words of love, gratitude, of closure that they need to have with others before they're ready. And so together we work on that. Again, I just had this case a week and a half ago. She got those things done. A few hours later, I came back and she said, can we start the medications now? So this is also where you guys as advocates can just ask these questions, both of your loved ones and of your medical team as well, too. What can we anticipate? Because at different stages of their disease, it might be just starting with a small dose for symptom management. They may have months left of life. I really right now work with people who are in the final week to days of their life, so just a little bit of a different circumstance with that. So things that we can do, first off, if you are somebody where it ties into these religious reasons, please talk with a religious leader. In hospice, our chaplains are great to either have these conversations or bring in the appropriate religious leader to have that conversation. If you are somebody with a history of addiction, talk with somebody who specialized in that. Get some perspective on what that means for you moving forward. Again, all of this is we have these conversations in advance so that way when we're in these pain crises, we're in these moments, we know what we want to do moving forward. And then again, have clear language in your healthcare directive. The last one we're going to talk about today is medical aid in dying. So medical aid in dying is a practice in which a mentally capable adult, so somebody over the age of 18, who has a terminal diagnosis and a prognosis of 6 months or less. So that's what the prognosis you have to enroll in hospice. And you are a mentally capable adult. You are capable of making this decision. If you meet all of that criteria, and this is, I'm talking about made within the practice of what's happening in the United States, not in other countries. Let's not compare this to Canada or other European countries. This is what's happening in the States. If you meet those qualifications, you can go to a trusted healthcare provider where they have a set of evaluations they do and a process that they have to do, but ultimately you can get a prescription that you have to self-ingest either by drinking or administering through your PEG tube, but no one can do this for you. You have to do it yourself to bring about a peaceful passing at the time of your choosing. This is not a legal option here in Minnesota, but I think it's important to talk about because we continue to see this coming up in legislation. We continue to see this on the news. And every time we're in session, I get more and more questions about this from our patients and our families. So this is something that people are thinking about. It is a very emotionally complex topic. We are not here to talk about the pros and the cons, to advocate for or against it, but just to give some knowledge about it as clinicians. To give a little bit of history, it became legal in Oregon in 1997, and currently there are 10 states, including the District of Columbia, where it is a legal option. In 2025, there were 18 states who had proposed legislation, so this continues to be a conversation throughout the United States. When we look at the data in Oregon, the people who commonly elect MAID are white. They are over the age of 65. They have a cancer diagnosis. Many of them die at home with the support of a hospice team. The primary reasons why people elect MAID is loss of autonomy, loss of ability to engage in the activities that give our life meaning, that give our life purpose, and loss of dignity. Pain, burden, those are there as well too, but these are really the top three. So for a lot of people, it really comes down wanting to control their death. Control what that looks like, decide, like I talk about this line in the sand of quality of life and quantity of life. The interesting thing when we look across different states is about one-third of the patients who, I mean, they have the prescription at home, they have it in their cabinet, about a third of them don't use it and they end up dying of their natural disease progression. Yeah, it's a heavy one. But again, we hear requests for it. And so as our role as clinicians is to support that. As a social worker, I spend time trying to understand the why that's underneath it. If it can be talking about bringing in a doctor like Dr. Sikora to say, these are the ways that we can treat your pain, to treat your symptoms. Shortness of breath is a huge one. And just to walk alongside and support them. But ultimately, here in Minnesota, there is nothing we can do to add to your care plan, like adding a medication that can hasten your death. But this is, again, where we educate that there are decisions that you can make along the way that would. We already talked about VSAID. We already talked about when your heart stops beating, allowing yourself or your loved one to die a natural, peaceful death. We've talked about not doing a tube feeding. I mean, we've talked about some of these already. One piece, and I'm going a little off topic, that we haven't talked about that I see a lot, especially in dementia, is I will have caregivers come to me and say, you know, Rosie, we treat our dogs with more compassion than we treat our human beings. Again, hold space for that. And then I'll think back and say, and now I'm much more assertive about this as I've grown in my years of experience, but I'll stop and I'll think, man, this person had pneumonia a month and a half ago and we treated it with an antibiotic. And when you look back at pneumonias, what do they call it? The gentle killer, the welcomed killer in the 80s?
Old man's friend, it used to be referred to, because before the advent of lots and lots of antibiotics, people have to die of something, and pneumonia was a common way for people to die.
And my understanding of it is, and from what I've seen, is it's a pretty peaceful passing.
It is. Relative to some of the other possibilities. There are legitimate occasional reasons to use antibiotics as people approach the end of life. I think the common one that I often use as an example is a urinary tract infection where somebody has active symptoms that are really uncomfortable for them. It makes sense to me, certainly, to treat that. But we often have to explore with patients or families, what is it that they're actually trying to accomplish with this antibiotic when they Because more often than not, they're the ones requesting it. We aren't often making a diagnosis of an infection and then suggesting an antibiotic. Usually it's the patients or families asking for one, and it requires some conversation to understand what their goals are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I want to say how proud I am of us for getting to this time where we have plenty of time for questions. That was really the goal. Look at us go. So I have learned today, because I have shown multiple people how to use a QR code. And Joe, do you know how to use access a QR code?
Maybe.
Maybe? and hear me, if you guys even email me at this, I am happy to email this resource guide to you. It was just like 6 pages long, so I didn't want to print off a whole bunch. But if you open up the camera in your phone and you zoom in on this, you will see a yellow link that comes up at the bottom. And if you click on that, that will give you instant access to this resource guide. The nice thing about doing it electronically is I have a lot of links on there. So directly from that, you can click on different links to get to that.
So, Rosie, this is like in a restaurant where they have a QR code to find out where what beer they have?
Yes, that's exactly what this is. So now we want to start by just saying, and I do have to preface this as well, too, we are here to give general advice. Joe cannot give direct medical advice to anyone. It's here just to give medical education. So try to keep the questions a bit more general, because we'd love to be able to answer. So I'm coming right away to you first, and apparently you have to speak into the box. I have no eye-hand coordination, so I'm like, I don't want to throw that at anyone.
The simple answer, if there is one, you mentioned earlier, the sisters have precedence over a spouse and decision-making in, I'll say, end-of-life decisions or just medical decisions in general. And I always thought the spouse had the number one choice, and then family members were number two.
No, let me clarify that. So with shared decision-making, what I'm saying is my husband does not override my sister. There's no next of kin laws. So that's where if I got in a car accident, my husband said, we're unplugging everything. She would not want to live a quality of life like this. And my sister comes in and she's like, do everything. By law, we have to decide, like until we can figure out that problem, we have to do everything to keep me alive.
Okay.
So that's really the importance of having this healthcare directive, because in Minnesota, literally everyone can come together. And if you have people that dispute that, it can cause a huge problem. They actually call it the daughter from California syndrome. The one that flies in, right, that hasn't seen mom or dad in months, if not years, and flies in and says, nope, we need to do everything we can. Does that help clarify the question for you, sir?
I mean, it does. I do have a healthcare directive, so for me it's not. But
you're
I
set.
The spouse always has precedence over...
And it's such a misconception, because I'll meet with people and they'll say the same thing. Well, how am I? I'm their husband. I'm their wife. Why can't I make the final call? And that's just not the way the law is set up in Minnesota.
Okay, and luckily, we being her sisters are all on the same page.
Love that for you. Yeah, thank you for clarifying that. Who else has got a question? I don't want to throw this at you. I'm sorry. It's just my, like...
So on that same topic, if the healthcare directive is in place, mm-hmm. but you still have family members that differ in what they want done, do they just go for... How does that play out?
Then they bring the social worker in to do counseling, but ultimately... It does not override the decision maker. So again, I'm going to use examples here of just continuing to use my husband and my sister here. My husband is my primary healthcare agent. My sister is my alternative. Even if my sister comes in and says no, my husband gets first say because he is my primary healthcare agent. If my husband's unavailable, then it goes to my sister. So if my mom were to come in and have an opinion, she's not my healthcare agent. So she has an opinion, but the physicians don't listen to that. They listen to the people that you elect as your healthcare agents. And this is why I commonly recommend as well, y'all, I've worked with some families where I go and they're like, we have 4 healthcare agents. They are all my children and they all have to agree. Don't do that. Please hear me loud and clear. Don't do that. Select one primary person, and I do recommend having an alternate for if some reason we can't get in touch with them. But please do not list 3 or 4 people and say they all have to be on the same page. That is leading for disaster for your family.
And make sure you talk with all of your children about who you chose and why you chose them. And because what also happens, even when there's a named agent who is on board with what the patient wanted, there's often a lot of pressure on them, and sometimes they'll just abdicate and say, well, you can do whatever so-and-so wanted. And so we want to avoid situations like that as well.
I mean, I've also had where I called up the healthcare agent in the hospital, and I'm like, you know, hi, I'm here. I'm sitting with your uncle at bedside. We wanted to talk to you about this. He listed you as the healthcare agent. He did what? Tell your healthcare agents, right? Make sure that they're aware.
Okay, so I just heard you say don't put three people together in charge.
No.
Okay, so...
God, no, please.
Interesting thought, because I, on my healthcare, have stated that I now actually have an 18-year-old, so I can change that. But I actually wanted my husband to talk to my daughters because they know mom in a different way than he does. So it's interesting you're saying that, because in my situation as of today, which in 5 years could be very different, as we all know, I actually wrote on mine to have my husband confide in the girls the decision that he is responsible to make, because they moved through me. So I feel like they know me really well, and I have a good relationship today with them. So I think that's another piece, is I'm the one who adds all the extras. So interesting you say that. Can you tell me a little bit why you don't think three people should talk about it together?
I will say first, from a logistics standpoint, I recently had this about a month ago. We wanted somebody to sign on to hospice, and it was urgent. It was immediate. This patient was suffering, shortness of breath. They wanted to get things going. One son was in Germany. We couldn't reach him. So by law, we could not sign her up for hospice because we could not reach all four of those agents. When we say all four of them have to agree, we have to have confirmation from all four of these people that they agree. Word of mouth saying, yeah, no, well, we talked with our brother, it's okay. Legally, it's not. We have to know. So from a logistics standpoint, I'll say that. And I'll tell you guys, from a relational standpoint, we talked about grief all morning. Can I tell you the primary emotion I see in this stage is guilt? And I literally gently have said to so many family members, I look them in the face and I say, can you tell me who we are doing this for? And so I would just say, even from a relational perspective, it can get really tough when it's like, well, no, well, maybe I've been the caregiver for mom for the last 5 years and you've been out of state. Like, you haven't even been here. So I just think from like a relational perspective and a logistic perspective, that it does get tough. I would very much recommend having a primary, and you can still have general wishes in there of, I ask my husband to have conversations with my daughter, but that doesn't put us in a legally binding spot. But when you list multiple agents, that does. Yeah. I'll get to you. You had your hand raised, right?
This may be a silly question, and I'm not sure, but what's the difference between having a will and having a health directive?
So a will is about your assets. It's about your things. Sometimes you hear the language living will, right? And the living will component, when you work with an attorney, that's usually the language they use. The living will component is surrounding your goals, your wishes, and your values for your health care. So, yeah, the language around it can get a little tricky, but a standalone will is just about, what do we do with my money? What do we do with my stuff? And a living will is usually legal language that they use. You know, in the hospital setting where I've worked a lot and in my own practice, this is what I do, is I sit down with families, and I have created, actually with the support of Dr. Sikora, a very detailed healthcare directive that I do with the clients that I serve. So it's all in one. We elect the agents, and we have these detailed conversations, so that way when people get to this point, we actually have a document that helps guide their care. Did that answer your question?
I just was wondering, if you have a person who, you know, is planning and is struggling with their healthcare directive due to lack of family or friends, and they live pretty isolated, or they don't trust family or friends, what do you usually suggest?
So I have done healthcare directives with people who can't list an agent because of the circumstance you're talking about. So then even more so, I am making that goals, values, and wishes piece abundantly clear. So that way they can still get scanned into their system. So that way if a guardian comes in and presumes their care because they become incapacitated, the guardian at least has this framework to know how they would want their care to be guided. Providers like Joe can at least can still navigate their care. I'm answering all the questions. You want to jump in?
No, you're doing
fantastic.
It's
ACP. I get so excited.
I think when people don't have a healthcare agent, and Dr. Sandler can speak to this too, as an ethics committee, often we're discussing, okay, what happens? They're now in a place where they can't make a decision, but they've made their wishes abundantly clear. And obviously, hopefully, nobody is arguing with that or conflicting with that. But having as much information as possible that's documented makes things better.
I had one person who said, under no circumstances do I want my sister or my brother-in-law making decisions for me. So they couldn't pick anybody, but they sure as heck knew who they didn't want making those decisions, and they put that in there. We have time for one more question.
Yeah, I was heard you say, talking about both pulsed and healthcare directive. So if a person has a pulsed, does that override the healthcare directive?
When it comes to the goals of care, yes. Would you agree?
Yes, I would.
So when it comes to the pieces surrounding CPR, tube feeding, antibiotics, the general goals for your care, when that's signed by a physician, again, that's like a medical order that follows you wherever you go. In the hospital, in your home, in a nursing home, in an ambulance. And so, you know, our healthcare directive is really a framework for how to guide the care, but that pulsed is, I mean, it's a legal document.
But you can change the pulsed at any given time.
You absolutely can. And I've had patients who have come into the hospital who have a DNR selective care pulse, but let's say they're going to go in and they're going to have hip surgery. And they say, okay, only during surgery, if something goes wrong, do I want CPR to attempt to be resuscitated. But as soon as I'm done and I'm back out in the community, I want to go back to DNR. These are always conversations and things that can be adjusted. Thank you for bringing that up. Y'all, you've been awesome. I know, again, I just want to validate that this is kind of some tough information to sometimes hear about. But we're grateful that you're here. And again, to our caregivers, man, we see this every day. We know this from professional and personal experience. You guys are heroes. Thank you for how you show up for people in our community. We appreciate you and we honor you. Thank you.